You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
The Dots and your Mark Shay. And we are here today on this fine. It is now the second week of Advent. Can you believe it? Christmas is going to be here in just, well, I'm going to say probably about like 2-3 weeks, something like that.
Yeah, it's going to go fast. It's going to go fast.
And as you can tell from her dulcet tones coming over the air, we are joined today by my Monday co-host, Sherry Antonetti, fine writer. And we have a special guest today as well. We're joined today by Mr. Tom Hoops. I've known Tom for, golly, 10 years, something like that, because Tom Hoops is the guy that approached me, asked me to write for the National Catholic Register, which he used to edit. He spent 10 years as executive editor for the National Catholic Register. He's contributed to places like Catholic Vote and Alitea. And Alitea, after Patheos, is the second most difficult to pronounce religious website. Catholic Digest. And he's got a brand new book out, which we're going to be spending some time today talking about, called What Pope Francis Really Said, which in my opinion there's a crying need for this book, because people spend an enormous amount of time, in my opinion, being radically unnecessarily confused. But Pope Francis says something and I go and read it and I go, yeah, okay, I can see that. And the next day I turn on the interwebs and all these people are freaking out about what Francis said this time, and they're having heart attacks and panic attacks and everything. And I'm going, this is really not all that complicated.
What would we do on Facebook if we didn't argue about what Pope Francis said? What would we do?
Exactly.
So anyway, I wanted to welcome Tom Hoops to the show. How you doing, Tom?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. The book has been out for about a month now. So I've been on the radio. I've done several talks trying to see how people are reacting to Pope Francis. And I've actually been pleasantly surprised. Sure. I think you have a lot of critics of Pope Francis that make a lot of noise, but there's a kind of a silent majority of people out there who are not as upset as some of the people that we sometimes read online.
I think that that's true. As a general rule, I usually make a very sound distinction between the kind of stuff that Catholics online say and the kind of stuff that, like, all normal Catholics say.
Right.
I had a friend, just to give you a sort of an example, I got a friend who's a deacon in the Archdiocese of New York, Deacon Greg Kandra. And he's kind of plugged into the news world because he used to work for CBS. And so he's aware of the news and pays attention to what's going on in Catholic websites and so forth. And he writes for Alitea and stuff. So anyway, when the big kerfuffle happened about 5 years ago with Father John Carapi, had his public implosion there. So online, it was just like wall-to-wall panic and hysteria in Catholic circles, in St. Blog's parish, if you will. And he was following all of this, and it just seemed like, you know, this gigantic crisis in the church. So he said he got on an elevator one day at the chancery in the Archdiocese of New York, where you'd really assume that, you know, these are people who are like, yeah, really, really in touch with all the stuff that's going on in the church, which is true. And he said, so how about this Carapi thing? And there were a bunch of other priests and deacons in the elevator, and they all looked at him and said, who?
Right.
I love it.
That tells me a lot about the priorities of what's actually going on, you know, in the real world, in the real Catholic world, is distinct from the kind of funhouse mirror that's often right. taking place in the cyberspace.
Saint blogs, yes.
So, so talk about your book a little bit.
Yeah, great. I was going to say, I think it's made a little bit worse by the fact that people, sometimes people would write very angry letters to the National Catholic Register about this or that Catholic thing that came up. And I'd call people because I felt really bad that they were so angry. And sometimes, often they were the sweetest people in the world. They were, they did not, I think part of it is people don't know how to criticize or how to express their concern without sounding just apoplectic with rage nowadays. I think we just don't have the language of civil discourse that we used to have. I think that's part of it. Anyway, people are upset about Pope Francis for good reason. He's says things in a way that is not as clear and as user-friendly as Pope Benedict and Pope John Paul II. Now, I'd like to point out that our two previous popes had academic careers. And if you meet university professors, you learn that these people kind of train their brains to think in complete sentences that are only and exactly the right thing to say. And they say it, and then a bunch of people write it down, and then if they say it a different way on a test, it's wrong, and they have to say it that way. So it's a discipline of the mind that comes with the, you know, territory with an academic. Well, Pope Francis never had that. He never had an academic career. He had a little bit of a career in high school, but he didn't have this years, decades of training his brain to say only the right thing. And you know what? He also doesn't have a lot of history with the press. When he was Archbishop in Buenos Aires, he refused to talk to the press. He said, you guys are just going to take my words out of context. You're going to confuse people. You're not going to tell them what the church is teaching, what I'm saying. You're just going to use it as hype. So he's very aware that this is what the press does, and he refused to talk to them when he was Archbishop of Buenos Aires. Mm-hmm. Now, as Pope, he clearly has made a decision that of the two kinds of communicators you can be, one is kind of, I mean, I'm going to use pejorative language, it doesn't have to be this bad, but one is kind of stage managed and carefully scripted. The other one is more, you know, free to tell you what's on his mind. He wants to be that second kind of person. And I think he's right that in the world today, people want to hear that second kind of person, and they're no longer listening to that first kind of stage-managed, scripted candidate, as we saw in the last election.
Yes, yes, yes.
Indeed. Yeah, and I think that's true. And I think also, you know, he's always struck me as somebody who, you know, he spent his life talking to, you know, I call him Jose Sixpack, you know, in the favela. I mean, that's where he spent his life. So he's not, he speaks in colloquial language.
Right. So this gets him in trouble, and it's a little bit different type of style that you have to deal with. When you're dealing with Pope Benedict, you're dealing with a guy who just reading him teaches you how to think better. I mean, he's just a phenomenal intellect. But from the first moment, I don't know if you remember, I read Pope Francis's first homily online the day that he gave it or the day after. Mm-hmm. And it blew my mind. You immediately knew. I mean, it was kind of stream of consciousness. There were awesome, beautiful things in it about how Christians have to rely on Christ. And if we don't, we're just an NGO. And he's going along, but he clearly is kind of making it up as he goes along. And then he says something that made my jaw drop. He said, and I wish I should have put the words in front of me because I've been telling this story a lot, but he said something about he who does not profess Jesus Christ professes the worldliness of the devil. Mm. So I pointed it out, and I ran up to the third floor here at Benedictine College to talk to the theologians. I said, okay, so the vicar of Christ just said that people who do not profess the divinity of Christ are devil worshipers. So he just said, that's what the words in the sentence that he said mean. He's saying that about Jews. He's saying that about all Muslims. And they said, no, he doesn't believe that. I said, I know he doesn't believe that, but the vicar of Christ just said it. They said, well, you've got to take it in context and realize that he likes to use hyperbole. And you have to just see who he was talking to and what he was
right. He's speaking to fellow Catholics.
Well, but then that became what I call the hermeneutic of Francis. Uh-huh. You don't just write it with Pope Benedict, you write down what he said, and those very words are the things which he meant, right?
Yes.
And you can take a sentence out of context, and it's hard to take a sentence out of context in Benedict and do damage to his message because his brain doesn't allow for that. But right. Francis, you've got to look at it in context. You've got to see who he was talking to, why he was talking to them. It's a harder job on the part of the listener. But I think it's also very rewarding because he says some very he kind of shocks the system a little bit and gets the juices flowing.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's part of his charism. I was joking one time on my Facebook page, and I said, someday when they canonize him, which I'm morally certain they're going to do, they need to give him the title Pope Francis the Unavoidable.
Okay. Well, that's absolutely true, you know. I saw somebody, I think on Catholic Thing, Robert Royal had a thing today about how Pope Francis, for all that you might complain about him, he makes you stop and say, wait a second, I keep complaining about how the government's serving the poor the wrong way. What the heck have I done?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's his charism.
We're up against a break, but we'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Sherry Antonetti and Mr. Tom Hoops, the author of What Pope Francis Really Said. And we'll be right back after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hi there. I can't really say M-I-C-K-E-Y because it has nothing to do with anything. But anyway, we are here on Connecting the Dots, and we're talking today with Tom Hoops, former executive editor of the National Catholic Register. Now, you're teaching, right, at Benedict College?
Oh, I've got a lot of roles here. I'm actually in the marketing. I help market the college. I'm also writer in residence. I also teach in journalism and mass communication.
Okay.
So they've got me doing plenty for my
doing a lot of stuff. Okay. And you are the author of What Pope Francis Really Said, which is what we've been discussing today. So you were saying before the break, you're talking about the different way in which Pope Francis approaches his relationship not only with the media but also, of course, pastorally, and the way he thinks and speaks, as distinct from somebody with a like a precision Swiss watch brain like Pope Benedict.
Right, exactly.
Very different men, you know.
Yeah, and he's coming from a very different background. So Pope Benedict, for instance, went from his academic career, which he used to fill halls, lecture halls in Regensburg, I think it was. He was a very popular professor. But somebody described his style, and I guess it was the style back then, is he would read a paper with his glasses on and, you know, looking down at the paper the whole time. And he'd fill these halls with that style. So he was never very media savvy, Pope Benedict. But he went from there to becoming a Vatican curial cardinal, Ratzinger did. Pope Francis, meanwhile, has been kind of in the rough and tumble of a parish life and of missions that he'd put on. He'd go out into the barrios in Buenos Aires. And then, of course, he was also a bishop and a cardinal in Buenos Aires. But he was also, at the same time, you know, he was known for being the bishop who rides the bus. So he comes from a totally different set of circumstances from the previous two popes, both pastorally and also kind of in his academic career.
Yeah. And I think that that really deeply, as you say, it deeply informs the way he looks at his mission as Pope. People have asked me, you know, I run into people all the time who are baffled by him, and I don't get what's so baffling about him. People ask me, you know, what's he up to? And I say, everything you need to know about this Pope is summed up in the words, he has preached good news to the poor.
Right.
Yes.
That's his whole papacy in a nutshell. And if you look at it, you know, if you look at what he does from that perspective, everything to me falls into place.
So, but I feel that pain. Okay, so I came from the church. I was born in 1969. I was raised partially in the 70s, partially in the 80s. And I received communion training in two different parishes because I, long story, but I got my first communion when I was 5, and then I went through it again when I was 7. Nobody in all of these parishes told me about the real presence. Nobody insisted that I go to confession before communion. I went through catechism teaching, or whatever they called it back then, CCD, and it plainly was something that A, had no relevance to my life, and B, whatever baggage these people had who are telling me that, you know, God is all love and he doesn't care what you do is the message I got from it. Right. I didn't want to be Catholic. I didn't see any need to be Catholic. So then when I discovered later in life the truth of the faith and the power of the faith and what's at stake with my eternal salvation and my soul and the weight of a human soul, I felt cheated by the experience of a kind of casual, I was about to say uncaring. I don't think these people are uncaring. I think they just didn't, they were going down a path that was not going to connect with somebody, the young people of today. So I feel their pain. When you see somebody like Pope Francis and you think, that reminds me of that CCD teacher who said, don't worry about going to confession, just, you know, do a felt banner that says reconciliation on it, and that'll be good enough. So I feel their pain when they see, I think I compare it to post-traumatic syndrome. Some of us who went through these kind of tough times in the faith, we're now kind of on edge. Whenever we see somebody who reminds us of those people who we feel hurt by, it sets us on edge. So that I describe in my book how my daughter had a totally different experience of Pope Francis from what I had. In the fall of 2013, which was his first fall, I was writing these articles trying to respond to Rush Limbaugh's tirade against Pope Francis. I was responding to all the people who were upset about the small-minded rules comment, which is almost word for word the same as a Pope Benedict comment, which is explained in the book. But at any rate, I was writing all of these just in this defensive crouch about the papacy of Pope Francis. Meanwhile, she was in Rome for her year abroad, or semester abroad, and experiencing Pope Francis one-on-one, and it was profoundly affecting her faith. And a friend of hers went from atheist to Catholic that semester, in large part because of his encounter with Pope Francis at the prayer vigil for Syria.
Wow.
So these people who don't have the post-traumatic stress disorder that I have, having been raised in the Catholic Church in the 70s, have a totally different and freeing understanding of Pope Francis. He's not, it doesn't set them on edge. They get it. They see what he's trying to do, and they don't have to reconcile it with their baggage.
You know, and of course the irony is that the people that taught you were themselves suffering from PTSD.
That's exactly true. You're right. Absolutely.
I remember going to this. We did this kind of this walkthrough of our parish one time, and the religious ed guy, was very clearly in severe reaction to whatever had gone on in the church before the council, which is now ancient history. You know, for your daughter, that's like, you know, the 50, 60 years ago, you know? And, but he, yeah, he was like, you know, talking about how Vatican II had thrown open the windows of the church and gotten rid of all of this stuff. And the whole, the audience that he was talking to was, had no experience of right. anything that had gone on in the church before the council. And in fact, the irony of the thing was after he gave this, you know, this glorious speech about how, you know, the spirit of Vatican II and et cetera, when it was all done, one of the catechumens looked at him and said, "You keep talking about this Vatican II. What was that?"
Yeah.
Never heard of it, right?
Oops.
But, you know, so for me, it was hilarious because, you know, I'm a convert to the faith and came into the church long after the council and totally missed all of this culture war struggle.
Right.
Between, you know, the pre-conciliar and the post-conciliar partisans and all of that. And that's only, you know, Vatican II is further and further in the rearview mirror now. And
no, it feels like the ship of Peter was in a storm for most of my life. Mm. And it kind of, the storm lifted during Pope Benedict's papacy, it seemed. I mean, at least within the church. This Catholic storm. The church is always in a storm in the world, but suddenly, you know, the voice came on the loudspeaker. You're free to walk about the deck now. You don't have to tie yourself to the mast anymore. And some of us didn't get the memo. It's hard. It's hard when you've been through a traumatic experience to say, you know what? Yeah, I'm going to trust that these guys know what they're doing. Suddenly,
yeah, as they say, unclench, right?
Yeah.
Well, I've you know, been skimming your book a bit, and I would go to the Pope Francis's tackling some of the tough issues that nobody wants to talk about. I think, okay, we all agree on this, so therefore we don't have to talk about it. And he goes and, you know, goes and washes the feet of men and women who are have same-sex attractions, who are in prison. He goes and meets with the people. He dines with sinners, as they were. And none of us like to think that we're the people saying he dines with sinners. But we're the people saying he dines with sinners, because we're trying to be on the good side in our Catholic faith. We're like trying to check off the box that we did everything right, and so we're wanting the Pope to affirm you did everything right. And I think that causes a lot of the anger that you see in public about Pope Francis. They want to be affirmed that they did it right.
One of the paradoxes that I've run into is because there is the problem of the media, you know, misreporting things that he says and that sort of thing. And they've always done that. I mean, they misreported what, you know, what John Paul said and what Benedict said and as well. But, I used to remark that, you know, when Benedict said something and the New York Times misreported it, people rushed out and said, that's not what Benedict meant.
Yes, yes, yes.
But now, when Francis says something and the New York Times misreports it, you get all these Catholics running out there saying, did you hear what the New York Times said that Francis said?
Yeah, I know.
I knew that he was a terrible pope. You know, it's like, relax, unclench. You know?
It will be okay.
Part of the problem is that Pope Francis does not... I'll tell you what part of the problem is after the break.
We'll come back from the break. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here today talking to Sherry Antonetti and Tom Hoops about what Pope Francis really said. And we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti, and we're talking with Tom Hoops about his book, What Pope Francis Really Said. And you were starting to say something before the break.
Well, I was starting to say that the reason people follow what the people get him wrong after reading the media, and they don't double check the what's being said in the media, because I think they've been a little bit beaten down by one report after the other, and some, it turns out, he really was challenging something they believed in. Mm-hmm. For instance, global warming. Now, Pope Francis is clearly sees global warming as a problem that's caused by Western affluence. Now, he says he can't define that as the church, and I think he can't. That's not part of the magisterium of the church to believe in a scientific. But when he says that, Catholic, part of the problem is, Benedict said that over and over again, and Pope John Paul II even made it a priority of the church to fight global warming in his document on Oceania. So we only hear about it when Francis says it. I mean, we should have been concerned about it years ago. Right. But the reason that the book came about is that I was asked by Servant Books to cover about 10 hot-button issues. And if you go through the chapters, there's about 10 chapters, and they cover one issue after another. There's economic issues, and there's homosexuality, war, abortion, and so on. And as I went through, the original assignment was just, what does Pope Francis say about each of these things? And then it became obvious it needs to be, what did he really say about each of these things?
Right, yeah.
But so often these things come in waves. So, for instance, the rabbit's comment is one that sets a lot of, and this is very upset. I'm among those Catholics who was upset when Pope Francis said this. He said Catholics must not be like rabbits, and was talking about large families and parental responsibility. Now, you have to understand, again, like we said, the Francis hermeneutic, who was he saying it to? What was the context? Remember that he uses hyperbole and memorable phrases. Mm-hmm. Well, he had just gone to the Philippines and defended the church's teaching on contraception. Now, if you've ever argued with somebody about the church's teaching on contraception, the talking point that they'll often go to is, the Pope is seriously going to go to a third world country and tell these people to have a lot of kids? That's ruining their lives, right? So he did the thing that the worst thing for a Pope to do in their mind is to go to the third world and tell people to have a bunch of kids. Well, he had just essentially done that by defending Paul VI in the Philippines. And on the way back on the plane, he was just getting hammered by these reporters because he had said the thing. He had done the dastardly deed that you must not do as Pope. There was a Crux news writer who said, I am devastated by this. I thought that the Pope was going to be on our side by the fact that he defended contraception. So they were really upset.
Proud to be Catholic.
They were hammering him on the plane. And finally he said, look, the church doesn't say people need to be like rabbits. It's about responsible parenthood. He was making the kind of argument that you make, after Thanksgiving dinner when somebody corners you and says, come on, seriously, the church wants everyone to have as many kids as possible? You say, no, that's not what the church wants. Okay, so, and then what he did is, I think it was 3 or 4 days later, he had a bunch of big families from Italy for a big photo op at the Vatican. I don't know, it must have taken 3 or 4 days to find big families in Italy, but they got him there to the Vatican, and he had all these beautiful quotes about how much he loves big families and how great big families are. But of course, that didn't get picked up by anybody, and nobody drew attention to that. Right. But meanwhile, I was upset. Lots of Catholics I know were upset. A friend of mine changed his profile picture to Bugs Bunny because he had a lot of kids.
Okay.
But this is what happens with Pope Francis, is that you have to do the follow-up and figure out, what did he really say, and who did he say it to, and why?
And that is true. One of the things that there was the interview that he gave in the New York Times. It was an interview. It was done with America Magazine, but the New York Times picked it up because he made the remark. I forget exactly how he put it, but essentially what he was saying was, don't make the pro-life movement into a kind of an idolatrous focus.
Right.
Yes.
Which, you know, people had conniptia fits about this. The end of all things, you know.
Yeah.
And what struck me about it and has struck me more and more about it was how prescient it was. I mean, essentially what he was saying was, remember, the church is not an ethical society first. That's not the gospel. As important as the pro-life movement is, that's not why the church was founded. Just right. as it was not founded to end slavery or do any other social good. The gospel is primarily about the life, passion, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Everything else flows from that. And if you get distracted from that by trying to turn the gospel into whatever, you know, your thing is, you've lost the gospel.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're the press secretary for a candidate, you don't invite somebody in and say, and the first thing you do is say, well, let me tell you all the things my candidate hates about you, right? Uh-huh. Or all the ways he thinks you're living your life wrong. That's not your lead. Your lead is, let me tell you about the strengths of my candidate. Well, obviously with Jesus Christ, it should be even more so. And it echoes. So what he did, what he said is that we can't be drawn into small-minded rules or something like that. Anyway, what Pope Benedict had said is that too many of our discussions are of multiple minor details, but rather we should keep our eyes in the first place on the greatness of Christianity. I remember when I used to do interviews, I would always expect them to ask me about ordination of women, contraception, abortion, and other constantly recurring problems. If we let ourselves get drawn into these discussions, the church is then identified with certain commandments or prohibitions. We give the impression that we are moralists with a few somewhat antiquated convictions, and not even a hint of the true greatness of the faith appears. Now, that's Pope Benedict. And when he said that, I didn't hear anybody decrying that Pope Benedict called abortion a multiple minor detail, along with contraception and ordination of women. Now, I understand where these people are coming from. I mean, people who have devoted their lives to helping save children and help women, you know, they rightly deserve some respect for that. And if they felt disrespected, I totally understand that. But the point that the popes, both of them, are trying to say isn't that you shouldn't be you know, fighting for life, is that you shouldn't make Christianity into a list of thou shalt nots.
Right. 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 Yeah. And what goes with it, of course, is, you know, that the more important something is, the easier it is to turn it into an idol. I was remarking to a friend the other day that, you know, I mean, the core of the Arian heresy was that it managed to make God the Father into an idol.
It's quite a talent.
It's just, I mean, but that really was what it did. Is it tried to split up the Trinity and then demote two of the persons of the Trinity because God the Father was the main attraction and he was the
real this is the constant temptation, and it's my temptation. I'm not immune from it, and this is what Pope Francis talks about all the time, is the temptation to ideology. You take a piece of the truth that can be an important piece of the truth. You make that the truth.
The whole
and
truth.
And everything else fades away and starts serving that one piece of the truth. And that's a short road to idolatry. The first three chapters in here, after the intro, are about the idolatry that Pope Francis sees in our attitude toward money, our attitude toward sex, and our attitude toward power. And how these three, it's the same as the golden calf. You know, it was a virile, powerful, sexual symbol made of gold and money. Our attraction toward these three things gets us off track with regard to homosexuality, with regard to our economic understanding, and with regard to the chapter that's after that, which is about war. And with regard to war as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that one of the reasons that Francis is such a challenge is because he smashes our idols.
Yes.
He does. Yeah.
And he's not polite about it. I mean, he's really he can be quite brutal about those kinds of things. You know?
You discover that you've got an idol when you start getting angry at Pope Francis for having smashed one of them, and you want to put it back together. So there you go.
Yeah,
that's a good way to think about it. And when something about what Pope Francis said bothers you, you should look into what he really said, but you should also look into your heart and see if he's saying something that's drawing on, you know, something that you learned or heard or an echo of in the gospel that you need to pay attention to.
Yeah.
Because Catholicism is not the warm, fuzzy thing that we learned in our catechism if we grew up in the 70s. It's prickly. It's good. It's infinitely good, but it should grate at some point. You know, the gospel grates if you read it and allow it to speak to you, because there'll be something you're not doing, some part of the whole truth that you've not fully embraced.
So this could be Pope Francis's motto. Instead of make America great again,
yes,
the G-R-A-T-E,
make the Catholicism greats.
make Catholicism great again, G-R-A-T-E.
There you go.
Yeah, well, right. There's a reason the gospel story ends the way it does. It's not because everybody said, you affirm me in my okayness, Jesus.
Right. I'm trying to think of a t-shirt that says, for the greater good, but that probably won't be reinterpreted correctly. Yeah.
Well, Tom Hopes, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. We will be back right after this with Sherry Antonetti, and we'll be doing post-game wrap-up and chewing over some of the...
Tom, it's great to talk with you.
Thank you so much, Tom. Have a good day, rest of the day. We'll be back in just a minute on Connecting the Dots.
There's more.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are back. We're back with Sherry Antonetti. Tom Hopes had to get going, but wanted to be sure to make clear that if you're interested in his book, What Pope Francis Really Said, you can get it on Amazon in Kindle form or in paperback form, and because Amazon now sells pretty much everything that in the world.
Love Amazon.
Everything that you could possibly need, including in my city, they're now selling groceries. So you can go online. Only in Seattle, you can go online, you can order a bunch of groceries, and they'll just deliver them to your house in like some ridiculous, you know, time. I don't know if it comes in with a drone or not.
Well, you ought to experiment with that before next week so we can find out.
Well, you know, I've already copyrighted the term skeet fleet to describe the Amazon drone fleet that's going to be fanning out across America and shortly thereafter being shot down by people who just... You just know it's going to happen. You just know somebody's going to go out there with their BB gun or their shotgun or whatever and blow Amazon drones out of the sky. And then they'll be like,
the drone wars have.
Yeah. and then there'll be this whole new form of crime that you've never thought about before, you know. So, but until that happens. We're going to be...
I'm tempted
to try ordering groceries just because I want to see if the drone's going to show up at my house. I live far enough north of Seattle that I don't know if drones would come out this far, but we'll find out.
Send out the drones. There ought to be drones. Sorry.
Yeah. So that's going on. But I was really struck by our conversation with Tom Hopes about this. It's interesting because although Tom is younger than I am.
Me too.
He was raised in the church, whereas I came into the church in 1987 with I have no history.
Right.
With the church. So, in fact, I tell people, you know, people, I will, because it's the convention in American parlance to describe me as having been a Protestant. But really, I was never much of a Protestant because I wasn't protesting anything. okay. I was an evangelical, but when I came into the church, I was coming into the church from completely outside, never been baptized, no contact with the Christian tradition hardly at all, except for, you know, the robe and watching Jesus of Nazareth, and when I was, you know, basically a young adult, and a Charlie Brown Christmas was like my major point of contact with the Christian tradition before I became a believer. The robe I thought was boring. That was kind of it. And so I had never been in a church for any particular reason, certainly never in a Catholic church. And so lacking the history, there was none of that, you know, PTSD that Tom was describing for people who were raised in the church, got the kind of crappy cut, color, and draw, you know, CCD catechesis that was all about
banner. Yes.
Yeah, the felt banners and the whole thing. And so there was no reaction. At no point did I ever say, I have been lied to. I've been deprived of a Catholic education by people who
should have known better. No.
Robbed me of it. You know, when I did come into the church, I got plenty of crappy, you know, RCIA experiences. I have three really dreadful RCIA experiences, but I didn't feel robbed by them, right, particularly because I knew going in that the Archdiocese of Seattle was like one of the screwiest archdioceses there was in the world. Especially in the mid-1980s. So I already knew there was going to be a challenge there. And being an evangelical, you know, what I learned as an evangelical was, if you want to get something done right, then just do it yourself.
Yes.
So we had these bad RCIA experiences. So finally we just said, well, okay, it looks like the laity in this town just can't get it together. So we just started something called the Seattle Catholic Study Group. And we just plowed our way through trying to learn about the church. And it taught us how to find primary resources. And you know, here's the documents of Vatican II. So go read them. You don't have to have somebody, you know, hold your hand through all of this.
You have permission to do your own research.
Yeah, man up. Use your brain. You know, here's a, you know, find a catechism. There was no universal catechism yet. So we went out and found John Hardin's Catholic Catechism, which for me was very, very helpful. And so we just kind of cobbled together a Catholic education in the faith and got our questions answered. It wasn't, there were a lot of things that I realized later that we missed because we didn't go through a good RCIA that would walk us through the the liturgical year and that kind of thing.
Right.
But I'm still grateful for the experience that we had, and because it taught us how to learn about the faith and to teach ourselves about the faith and where to go and be able to recognize when somebody was feeding you a line of bull. You know.
Yes.
Even if it was like a priest feeding you a line of bull, which I got, you know. I remember Sherry Waddell and I one time, we went to this, we were both going through this at the same time. We were the ones that started this.
Wow.
It seems to have panned out, you know. But we started this Seattle Catholic Study Group because we went to this one thing where, you know, the priest was explaining to us that the Book of Exodus, Sherry, is like a father stands at the rim of the Grand Canyon with his son, and his son asks him, how did this get here? Where did it come from? And the father then tells him the story of Paul Bunyan walking past, dragging his axe behind him. And in the same way, Jewish fathers told the story of the Exodus to their sons.
No!
And, you know, Sherry and I were both listening to this going, this is a load of BS, right? I'm certain that the church does not say
paging the blue ox, placing the blue ox.
But yeah. That's, you know, that's what Tom Hopes is responding to.
Yes, and
that kind of catechesis. And who could blame him for going, I never want to go back to that?
You know? Well, because it's not good. It's not right. Good. You know. But when you but to go back to what, you know, that is what people are reacting to. I also think that we're just used to a very different kind of pope. And in, you know, with Pope John Paul, we've known him for so long. He was familiar. And then Pope right. Benedict, he was very, you know, if you read his writings, everything he ever wrote was so lucid. You know, you had no confusion yeah. whatsoever. But, yes. you know, when you got Pope Francis, you got someone who went out and did and who is going out and doing. And I mean, like when I watched his beginning of his papacy, I felt like he went out. And he was trying to illustrate through living the Beatitudes so that we would right. see how, what Catholicism is supposed to look like.
Right.
Manifested. And it's all about relationship. And where I go is everybody knows the image of Pope Francis touching the man's face who was covered with boils, with wounds.
Right. Right.
And that was it was not about him showing how holy he was. It was about him loving that particular man.
Right.
And showing him love. And that is what we're supposed to do. And it's not a theoretical thing that we're supposed to go out and find the people who are hungry, or the people who are naked, or the people who are mourning, or the people who are in jail. It's a reality. We're supposed to go out and find the hungry. We're supposed to go out and find the poor. We're supposed to go out and find the mourning. We're supposed to go and find the meek. We're supposed to be merciful. We're supposed to be pure of heart. We're supposed to go and do these things, not to do them like social, like we got to do something, but because we love the people that we encounter.
Right. As the fruit of our relationship with Christ. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing about Francis is that you know that this comes from a real interior place. He's not doing this because...
This is not symbolic. I'm going to go sit with the poor kids here.
Right. He's doing this because he means it, you know?
Yes.
And that's why, you know, that's what, as Tom was saying, that's what the younger generation sees, because they don't have any of the baggage.
Yes.
They're not refighting, you know, battles about bad catechesis in the 1970s because they weren't even born until 1995.
Right. Which makes it easier to
those
battles.
yeah. So that's it's really important for us to grasp that, because Francis really is all about evangelization. And that's why he does those things, is because he has preached good news to the poor is a living reality for him.
And that's what he wants for all of us.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Sherry and Tanetti.
Sure.
Our producer today was Danny Head, and you've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media tomorrow with Mr. Michael Litchens. Until then, have a great evening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.